Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Missing Frames. This is the podcast where we watch all the movies we should have seen by this point in our lives. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge. We're hanging out over on the Nerd Party Network. It is a wonderful group of people, a wonderful network where we talk about all things nerdy. Go check it out at thenerdparty.com. Make sure you're following us on Twitter at Join Nerd Party. Like the Facebook page, which is just facebook.com/thenerdparty. And make sure to follow us on Instagram at The Nerd Party. But we are now, it's officially spooky season. Is that what the kids are calling it now? Spooky season?
Yes.
Yes, exactly. So we got to get some horror movies on the docket. And I think we've got the perfect horror movie to watch. It's one that I haven't seen. It's Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. And I have invited two of my absolute favorite people to introduce me to this film. First, we've got John Mills, a fellow member of the Nerd Party. John, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on, and we continue the fine tradition of me being on for a sequel.
That is exactly. I'm glad you picked up on that. And also, we've got Brad Gullickson of the Rest in Pictures podcast and the Comic Book Couples Counseling podcast back again.
Hello!
And I'm glad we were able to get you on for what could very well be the greatest episode of Missing Frames.
Oh, let's be real. I bullied my way onto this episode because I heard you were going to be talking Halloween 3, and I don't want to out anybody just yet, but I heard that someone has seen Halloween 3 and doesn't quite get it. And I didn't want this episode to be like two people hating on a masterpiece. And so I said, no, Sean, I got to come on. I got to be the voice of the people. I got to be the voice for Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
You know, it's really interesting because I happen to know the way that this came about from my perspective. Was I was listening to what I felt was actually an excellent episode talking about Demon Knight, which is a movie I saw in the movie theater and love. I still have a very fond spot in my heart for it. It's better than I like it better than it deserves, probably. And I enjoyed listening to it. And then somebody on that show said something insane, like referring to Halloween 3 as a masterpiece. And I was like, oh, I stopped the audio and I called Sean up and I said, Sean, I have to talk to you for a second. And that's how that started from my perspective.
And how it started from my perspective was just this. It was a train wreck. I was like, these are two people I don't want to talk to at all. Why are they both messaging me about a movie I don't want to see? That's not true. I actually am genuinely excited to see this movie. And again, just to we've done a couple Halloween related episodes, I believe, I just did one with John and we watched I had not seen Halloween 2. I'm a big fan of the first Halloween, and I had never gotten around to seeing the sequel. And I watched the latest Halloween sequel, the 2018 film, and we chatted about those. So go back and listen to that. But just to reiterate, I am a huge fan of John Carpenter's first Halloween movie. I think it's wonderful. It's a near perfect slasher film. Wasn't as big of a fan of Halloween 2. It felt like it just kind of was like the weaker version of Halloween. And then I know, John, you and Brad as well liked the 2018 kind of requel a little bit more than I did. I wasn't a huge fan of that either. And part of the thing is I think you got almost everything you needed to say about Michael Myers out in the first one. And there wasn't much left for me to appreciate or to latch on to after that. So for me, there's almost a weird appeal to watching Halloween 3, which is a film that has been much maligned by fans of the franchise. This is very much the black sheep of the Halloween franchise. I know it barely has anything to do with the others. If anything, it was a specific creative attempt on the part of the creative team to try something completely different and veer the Halloween franchise off in another direction, partially because I think they were feeling a lot of the complaints I had about Halloween 2, which is, I don't know if we can get much more mileage out of this Michael Myers character. Oh, how wrong they were. But I know there are things, I've seen bits and pieces of Halloween 3, and I know it's a controversial entry in this franchise, but there's something about it from what I've heard, and especially nowadays, because now we have apologetics for literally everything. There are people popping out of the woodwork and saying stuff like, oh, Halloween 3 is actually a misunderstood masterpiece. Brad, but I want to kick things off first and foremost with John. We'll start with you as kind of the biggest Halloween fan I know. When did you see Halloween 3 and how devastated were you?
On television as a kid, which is how I encountered the first two as well, which is why actually what's really, really interesting, and I've covered this before, but like my first exposure to the very first Halloween was the infamous TV version. And so when I finally saw like the real version on VHS later, I was like, where are the missing scenes? What's going on here? And so that was always really interesting. But Halloween 3, I happened to, you know, was on television. And of course I saw, you know, Halloween 3. I was like, oh my gosh, of course I want to watch Halloween 3. Now I'm gonna say right here, as a kid, I rolled with it. And I actually had very fond, nostalgic memories of the movie, you know, thinking, you know what? Yeah, it doesn't fit. I wish it had been Michael Myers. But hey, you know, that ending and that, you know, all of that stuff was really interesting. And I loved, you know, the masks and all of that. And who doesn't love the iconic commercial, which is one of the greatest fake commercials ever created. And then I went back and I revisited it when I was a bit older, and I said to myself, boy, I really wish I'd left that to my television memories. and that's my story with Halloween 3.
And Brad, I want to hear your story. We've already established that you are that apologetic. You're the person going to bat for this movie. I think you've gone so far as to call it your favorite Halloween sequel. Clarify these comments for me.
I mean, there's a few things. You've said so many things that I take issue with since this episode has started. It's hard to figure out like where I'm going to start.
That's normal, though. Yeah. I always expect that you will take issue with things I have to say.
But one, I don't consider myself an apologetic. I consider myself a celebrator. Yeah, a celebrator of Halloween 3. there's nothing to apologize about. It's do I say this now and completely invalidate everything going forward? Like, everyone's just going to shut off after I say this, and I'm going
embrace
to lose.
It.
Say
I'm going to
say
I'm
it,
lose
Brad.
Everyone. But it's the best Halloween film. Okay.
Now,
and by best, I mean favorite. Let's be real. Like, art's subjective and all that. There's no such thing as a best. So I'm going to go with a favorite. It's my favorite Halloween movie. Now, when I grew up with these films, I knew well before I ever saw Halloween 3 that Halloween 3 did not have Michael Myers. For the longest time, because of that reason, I skipped Halloween 3. I never watched it as a kid. Mm-hmm. I never watched it when I was in high school. I watched Halloween's 1, 2, then 4, and blah, 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 blah. So many Halloweens. So many bad Halloweens. Some really good Halloweens.
Very true.
Some really good Halloweens, but so many bad Halloweens. I did not see Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, until college. And by that point, I had already become a maniac for Tom Atkins, the star of this movie, thanks to films like Night of the Creeps and The Fog and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love with Halloween 3 as a cheesy, silly, goofy, weird as hell movie that has nothing to do with Michael Myers. If you're in a Michael Myers frame of mind, this is offensive, and I apologize, but it's not. It shouldn't be called Halloween 3. It should just be called Season of the Witch, and then they should have sued Nicolas Cage when he stole that title for his Medieval Times movie with Ron Perlman, which is actually also pretty good.
Yeah, well, you know what? To be fair, Donovan should have sued them for having something called Season of the Witch and not using his classic hippie song.
Yeah.
So, you know, everybody's that's suing true. Everybody. But, like, yes, okay, just to speak to what you're saying, though, Brad, like, I can respect it if you're coming from the angle of this is a kitschy midnight movie. You know, we all went out and we watched it. We had a good laugh. And then we went out and we got drunk afterwards sort of thing. But, like, I can't. I look forward to subjecting myself to this movie once again, because the last time I watched it, of all things, I was on a plane trip And a friend of mine gave me access to their digital copy so I could watch it on my iPad. And I said, yeah, you know what? I broke out how the flight was. I was like, yeah. Up to that point, I'd had the initial reaction as a kid. Then I revisited it and said, this isn't very good. And I said, you know what? Let me give it another shot. And here I am on the plane and I'm watching it on this trip. And I just remember sitting there staring at it and saying, oh, come on. And just kidding. It has nothing to do with it being not a Michael Myers movie at that point. Now, again, I'm very curious to go back and revisit it because anybody that knows me knows that I despise flying. It immediately puts me in a bad mood. So it's entirely possible that I was addled by, you know, pressure variances and being a mile in the air and stuff like that. But I really don't think so.
This is also one of what, three or four movies that this director has done, Tommy Lee Wallace.
Oh, yeah.
I know you guys know, and I am talking to the right people here, but my understanding is that the producers wanted to veer away from Michael Myers-centric. Was John Carpenter consulted? Was he on board with this
yes.
franchise?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he was.
Yep.
I am amazed by that.
Well, here's the thing. Halloween 2 is an atrocity, right? Like, you come off of the first Halloween, and it's very much a wannabe movie, and they should
have turned... Well, let's make this clear. That's another thing that's going to make people turn you off. They're going to somehow find a way to circumvent technology, mute you specifically, and only listen to me and John. But they're about to mute me, too, because I know the general opinion is that Halloween 2 is the only good Halloween sequel, quote unquote.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
I agree. I did not like Halloween 2.
Like, Halloween 2 compared to Halloween 4 and 5 is good. Okay.
Oh, everything compared to Halloween 5 is good. Good Lord.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Halloween 2, I freely admit its shortcomings. It is a victim of imitation. There are like three different cuts out there, and your reaction to it can vary greatly by which cut that you see. And because I remember on the behind the scenes stuff, they even asked the director, well, how do you feel about a director's cut versus a producer's cut? And he actually had an incredibly philosophical response where he said, you know, it's my job as a director just to deliver whatever cut I can. And, you know, it's not really totally just my movie. And I was like, oh, that's a way to take it, buddy. But like Halloween 2, I think, has the reputation that it does because that last act is really good. A great ending can completely make up for the foibles of, you know, if you have an hour and a half movie, a great last 15 minutes, especially in a horror movie, can make up for a whole lot of shortcomings.
Yeah.
And, what happens at the end of Halloween 2 again? Let's spoil it for everybody.
Well, that's where, you know, Michael is, chasing. He finally Laurie and the Shape engage. And then she's in the parking lot, and then he comes across, you know, they have him, you know, he goes through the plate glass of the door, and they shoot him, and then he cuts the cop's throat, and they wind up in the surgery, in the operating room. Okay. And at the end of it all, after actually some really beautifully staged stuff, like Michael gets shot in the eyes, and he has these bloody tears coming down his face.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And it all culminates with Loomis flipping his lighter open near the oxygen tank that's spewing oxygen in. And he says, goodbye, Michael. And he clicks the lighter and the operating room explodes. And you see Michael walk out on fire. And then he falls down and burns to nothing. Everything wraps up. Cue Mr. Sandman. And so that's the end of two.
Yeah. And again, the consensus is that Halloween 2 lives up to the first one, but I'm siding with Brad on this because I watched it and was very much like, I didn't need this at all.
Yeah, and they should have gone right into the anthology series then. Like, if Halloween 1 was the Michael Myers movie and then Halloween 2 was Season of the Witch or something else, I think Halloween could have been a fun anthology series a la what Tales from the Crypt was trying to do with Demon Knight and Bordello of Blood. But, because they go Michael Myers, then Silver Shamrock. What's all this stuff then? It's very confusing and I'm sure agitating towards the fan base that had developed after the first two movies, which are straight up slasher flicks.
Well, and the thing is, I agree with you actually in principle here because of the fact that Carpenter didn't even really want to do two. He couldn't figure out a hook for two. And that's where the whole sister thing came from. I think the story goes that he was up late one night after drinking several six packs and he had writer's block. And then he said, they're brother and sister. And that's how that came into being, supposedly. And that's why when they went back and they could film in those extra scenes for the television airing, why they were able to flesh things out back through the first one to make it seem like it was all planned from the beginning. And it winds up confusing everybody's memory of it, because a whole ton of people are like me, where they encountered it on television at first. And it's like, well, of course, yeah, they dropped hints that it was his sister. But if you look at the original, no, they did not have that in mind at all.
I'm willing to give it a shot because of the fact that I wasn't a huge fan of Halloween 2 for the reasons I already explained, but also for the reasons of I love Michael Myers, but to me, it's not like a Nightmare on Elm Street thing, where with a Nightmare on Elm Street, Freddy Krueger, even if the movies aren't great, you have the creativity of Freddy is the dream master and there will be creative kills and all sorts of insanity, bonkers imagery, great production design. And the problem with Michael Myers for me is that once you show him killing people, and to me, there are a few things as chilling as when he stabs the guy against the cabinet and just kind of like cocks his head and sort of admires his handiwork. That to me is the epitome of like, okay, that is the best of what Michael Myers has to offer as far as killing goes. So why I haven't felt the need to watch more of the films in this franchise is because of the fact that I'm like, well, he stabs people and he chases people and I get it, but there's not a whole lot of variety to it, which kind of makes me susceptible to being more accepting of a movie like Season of the Witch, which I also think because it's been planted in my head that it's so typically the standard of that film is it's so bad and it's so terrible and it's an insult to Halloween. I'm almost like more, I feel like I'm in a position, I have an advantage because of the fact that I've been hearing such negative things about it that I can only imagine my reaction at the very least will be like, oh, that wasn't that bad. But I think with the advantage of foresight and the unique fact that I have not really been super into this franchise, I think makes me much more open to the prospect of a film like Season of the Witch.
I do think you're in a good position. Like there is definitely a, you know, a sort of like preparation to it. Like if you know what to expect going in, of course your reaction is going to be molded by that. And I will just be very, very interested because I do think that a lot of forgiveness again goes toward horror movies that have strong endings. And as much as I do not love Halloween 3, I think it has one of the most iconic and terrific endings of any horror film that I've ever seen.
I mean, it's a great ending. I like, to me, Halloween 3 is nothing more than a B movie, Sean, and you got to come at it with that sort of attitude. But it's not all about laughing at the movie. Certainly there's things in it that are questionable. Tom Atkins's relationship with the female partner in this age-wise is weird. Their sexual tension is awkward and inappropriate and strange. But there's also a lot in this film that I think is genuinely interesting or straight up gorgeous. I think the cinematography is stunning. It's shot by Dean Cundey, who the same year shot Carpenter's The Thing. He would go on to shoot Jurassic Park. You know, like this guy is a major visual talent. And there are lots of shots in Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, that are frameable. And I think that's an interesting place to come from on it. I also like the score of this movie. It is very much an 80s score. It takes the iconic theme of the original Halloween and grinds it through a synthesizer, and I appreciate that as well.
I'm also gonna guess that there's a Michael Myers reference, maybe a kid wears a mask or something. Let me take this moment now, since I'm kind of guessing what this movie's about, I'm gonna try to guess what the plot of the film is.
Good.
I don't know if there's a lot to guess. Like I feel like whatever I come up with is not going to be as insane and ridiculous as the film, but I know Shamrock, I think, is the television station that there's this whole undercurrent of like there's television and it's brainwashing our kids, and there's some sort of sinister plot to like on Halloween to get these kids to put on their masks. I remember seeing that and watch the TV show at a certain hour. I also, when I haven't seen the film, I try not to look too much into it, but I did see on Wikipedia, the first sentence already has my interest piqued, which is, Season of the Witch is a 1982 American science fiction horror film. And I'm like, science fiction? What the hell is going on? So, I guess science fiction plays a part in it, which feels about as contrary to what I've come to know about this franchise. But I think that can be expected from this film. So that's pretty much all I got. I'm guessing this guy, it's going to be kind of a situation where this guy is uncovering the plot of this evil corporation and has to convince everyone that he's not crazy, that it's actually happening. And I won't lie, I am excited to watch it, simply more, not even because I really want to see it. I'm more excited to just hear what happens when we come back to discuss the film in part two of this episode. But gentlemen, any final words, anything else before we make this happen?
Yeah, I would say, I'm going to go into this. I'm going into this with as open a mind as I can. That's what I'm going to say.
And how many times have you seen it, John?
Oh gosh, I've seen it definitely more than 5 times, probably around 10. Listen, okay, and before people sit there and say, but you said you don't like the movie, I watch a lot of things I don't like more than once. I have no idea why. Brad's own movie group up in Virginia hosted a showing of Star Trek V, and I practically dragged people to go see it because I love Star Trek V.
Yeah.
And so, like, Star Trek V is a much maligned movie, and I'm championing the hell out of that thing.
Well, this is the first time the three of us have done an episode together, but I think it's important to point out that Star Trek V, going to see that with you, John, was what reconnected me with Brad. So somehow this feels like we've come full circle.
Huh, nice.
And I can only expect that this film will be a semi-religious experience for all of us.
All right, first you know off, what? You, no. You're, mm-hmm. It's not Star Trek V, guys. It is not a masterpiece in disguise. But it is a really good little flick. I'm super excited to revisit it. I've seen it way more than 5 times. It is the Halloween movie I watch every year. And I watch all the Halloween movies. I've got that Shout Factory box set, even 4 and 5, which I was just taking a dump on. I like those movies too. But 3, I just feel like, because it's such an oddity in that box set within this franchise, it does tend to elevate itself above the others in my mind because it's so strange and shouldn't be. And as such, you know, I really do delight it. And I use a lot of hyperbole around it, but legitimately it's my favorite Halloween film. So when we come back, you know, just don't rip me a new one. That's all. I'm tender.
Well, only time will tell. So stick around, listeners, and we will be back to discuss Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
Now available to own on video cassette.
All right, we're back. We've all just watched Season of the Witch. So there's a scene in this movie where Dr. Daniel Chalice is bound to a chair. He's got a mask on his face, and they're forcing him to watch the original Halloween on television. And all I could think was like, wow, that is the perfect torture, because in that position, all he's probably thinking is, God, I wish I'd been watching that movie. John, you know how much I love to disagree with you, to find a reason for us to hate each other, but
yes,
I'm going to have to side with John. I did not like this movie. And Brad, I am so sorry. You need to be the full-on supporter of this film for this portion of the episode.
Sad for me.
You're going to have to step it up a little bit, which I know you're ready for, but
I was expecting it. I was expecting it.
Yeah, so it's just the fact that it wasn't, I mean, it was stupid. Let's be clear. This is a very stupid movie, but it was the fact that on every level, because I tried to watch it, okay, it's not really a Halloween movie, but then I just couldn't get over the fact that It's like, yeah, but it has Halloween in the title. Would this movie have even been made if it wasn't Halloween and John Carpenter wasn't involved? Probably not. And then I just tried to watch it as a standalone movie, and I was like, well, this is just kind of boring. It's not particularly scary, and it's not goofy enough to keep my attention. So it just on every level, I couldn't get into it. There are things I liked about it, but on the whole, I did not like it.
Now, see, I'm going to provide a little bit of support to Brad here, where watching it through this time, the first, you know, I guess 2/3 of it, I'm like, okay, this isn't good, but it's not offensively bad. It's, you know, I'm going along with it. Okay, let's have fun, all of that sort of thing. And I'm like, it's obviously a product of its time. It's somebody sitting down and saying, computers, they do things with computers. We can do things with computers. And there was a whole rash of those movies throughout the 1980s where people who didn't understand technology suddenly wrote stuff about technology, right?
Let's take a moment to acknowledge the greatest Computers Exist movie, Superman 3.
Yes, that's an excellent point.
Another
actually.
Great
yes.
third movie in a franchise.
Yeah, yeah. But then it hits this third act where there could be this tremendous payoff, and it's set up and you're like, okay, show it to me. I know you got it in you. The mask, the kid melts. All right, we're getting into the thick of it. And then it's just almost like the ending of the movie is an afterthought. And it's so disappointing because there, throughout this entire experience, there are things you could hold on to. But at the end of it, from my perspective, it's all looking at it and saying, man, if somebody else had just taken a pass at this script, maybe they could have done something to breathe some more life into it.
Well, you know, I really feel, I agree with you, John. I think there are so many things working against it. Again, like I said, having it attached to the Halloween brand only hurts it, as we've discussed in part one. But I couldn't enjoy it separated from that either. Like, even as a standalone, weird, wonky kind of thing, I just couldn't get into it. And part of it was just the overall threat felt so pedestrian. Like, it felt like, okay, it's an evil
ahead
of
the world, Sean. It's the end of the world. This is an apocalyptic movie. All the children are dying.
I mean, that all sounds great on paper, but in the movie, it's this guy. It's basically, okay, this guy is like this business mogul. He's a millionaire who's gotten rich because he's the most popular mask maker, Halloween mask maker in America. And you're trying to figure out, okay,
he created
the
soft chainsaw, Sean, the soft chainsaw.
Well, let's also keep in mind, he created sticky toilet paper too. I mean, that's
sticky
a legend.
Sticky toilet paper, the dwarf gag.
Okay. All right. Well, okay. Let's be real.
He has
made some accomplishments.
Power.
This movie, A+. So, but really, the whole thing, I was trying to understand. Okay, so he has set things up. They've stolen a portion of Stonehenge. I'm going to try to just like understand the evil plot. They've stolen a portion of Stonehenge, and the plan is they're going to take little like grams of Stonehenge, put them in these these silver shamrock badges, insert them into masks so that they can sell them to all the children all over the world, or not over the world, all over the world, I guess all over the country. We don't get a sense of worldwide scale, but all these kids in America will tune into this television program at a particular time where they will send out a signal that will zap and murder all the children, make them spew snakes and insects, and create, I guess, open the door to the apocalypse, as you're saying, Brad. Which, again, if somebody had told me that was the evil plot of this film, I would have been like, I am 100% on board. But it unfolds in like this, it's not creepy. The guy, now the actor who plays what is his name?
Dan
O'Hurley.
Yes.
From RoboCop.
He's great.
That's right. And the Last Starfighter.
He's great, and he's also just like he's a Bond villain basically, and just like walking.
Yeah, you know what's great, Sean?
Around.
James Bond movies. Now you're taking a dump on James Bond movies. How dare you? That is repulsive. You can't call yourself a movie fan and take dumps on James Bond movies.
Well, some of them you can.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
I don't want large scale. I don't want a large scale like villain lair with a villain who waxes poetic about his evil plan in a horror movie, unless it's done super tongue in cheek. And this movie is completely straight faced. So I was just like, I wanted to laugh. I chuckled. I had a couple good laughs. I mean, it was pretty great when they demonstrate the power of the Stonehenge and the Silver Shamrock badge, when the kid just falls apart and his parents start screaming. That was pretty funny. But I couldn't get into it mainly because the horror elements that are necessary for a film like this called Season of the Witch, that's about, again, unleashing the apocalypse, human sacrifice. This movie just felt very like a very, very bland semi Invasion of the Body Snatchers ripoff, but not even with the creepy undertones of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So I was just trying to find something to latch onto. And I couldn't. Brad, just give this movie, I need a solid defense of this movie.
I mean, for me, like, I hear what you're saying, and watching it last night, I'm watching it with the glasses of a hater because I knew what I was getting myself into. And I was like, okay, I can see the things that a hater would latch onto. And I don't even necessarily disagree with your comments. It is ridiculous or stupid, to use your word, although I don't love people based on their intelligence, Sean. But what I like so much about Halloween 3 is what an oddball it is. You're right. It's not scary. It's not, it doesn't achieve that if that's what it's going for, but it's a really, really weird movie that opens with this foot chase with this guy carrying a Halloween mask. He's running for his life. He goes through that gas station, and there's these weird emotionless white dudes in business suits. They look like IBM consultants, and they rip his head from his shoulders. Like, and it's got the best pop squirt sound effect. It's like your fist coming out of a mayo jar. It is so good, that sound design. And you're like, okay. The other Halloweens had Michael Myers, and now we're watching weird business dudes kill people. Okay, and they got Halloween masks, and there's this commercial going on. Really terrible. Like, it's awful. It would never get on air, but it's like the idea of what a terrible commercial might sound like for a mask company. And you have this hero in Tom Atkins, who's this philandering doctor who loves to operate while drunk. He's a terrible shit to his wife, played by Nancy Keys, who plays Nancy Loomis.
Which,
in the
by the
Halloween
way, I forgot by the end of the movie, I forgot he was married and had kids, because that never, I correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that ever comes back again.
Oh, no, it does.
He calls his wife.
Yes, right.
But that's it. And there's nothing at the end to
and
suggest that
still,
he cares at
she's
all.
She's like, I'm not listening to you because you're a terrible husband. I don't care what you're saying about my children being turned into bug people.
Right.
And
at
like,
the very
Tom
least, it at the very least, it underlines the importance of being a good father if you're going to be a father.
Yes, sure.
Right? Because if
yes,
you're a terrible
yes.
father, you will not be able to prevent your kids from being turned into bugs.
Yeah. So that's that's one good thing this movie does.
And the movie thinks he's this huge sex maniac because he's hitting on his nurses. He's hitting on the lady performing the autopsies. He bags this girl who is, I checked, 24 years younger than him. And
oh my God,
he is so not sexy. Like, I love Tom Atkins, but he's super not sexy. But the movie still gives him a butt shot, and I respect that. Thank you for the butt shot, Halloween 3. And so, like, it's a very strange character to follow. Very strange character.
Yes,
but I find him appealing.
One of the more uncomfortable moments in the movie is when they're in bed together and he crawls on top of her. Mm-hmm. And I just had a moment where I was just like, I no longer know what I'm watching.
I will top that because I will say that even more uncomfortable is when they're in bed together and he stops her and he says, "How old are you?" And at that point, I'm thinking to myself, if you have to ask, that's a problem. That
and
is
also
an issue.
If you waited to ask,
right?
After
yeah.
Bad dude, he's a bad dude.
But he's kind of, you know what's funny though What is the actor's name? It's Tom Atkins.
Tom Atkins.
Yeah.
Tom Atkins. So what's funny about it is Tom Atkins, I was watching some of the behind the scenes stuff, and he comes across as a lovely human being. And that's reflected in the way people, the other actors talk about him. That's the reflected in the way the filmmakers talk about him. And somehow he's able to take this, like you said, he's a womanizer. He's pretty despicable. He abandons his family. Somehow, I didn't really love the characters. I didn't care about anybody. I didn't really care what happened to them. And I was just baffled by, like, why is this doctor and this dead man's daughter suddenly they're in bed together and now they're going off on an adventure to do some detective work. I was just so baffled by just how we got from point A to point Z. But at the same time,
but it's in that bafflement, Tom Atkins, Sean, where the enjoyment happens. You gotta
Brad, let me compliment the movie.
I'm trying.
Give me a second to compliment it.
I'm defensive. I'm defensive.
All I want to say is that even though I didn't like the characters, Tom Atkins is so inherently likable and has such a likable screen presence that you don't hate Dr. Chalice, which is
right.
Stunning to me considering everything he does in this film.
Thank you, Sean, for acknowledging the brilliance of Tom Atkins. I really appreciate that. And as the movie progresses and you start to go, hold up, this is a Halloween film about an Irish toy maker who steals Stonehenge to take down the Americans during this holiday season. All right, that makes zero sense. But I appreciate that somebody thought it did. And that's the kind of appeal with these kinds of movies. They are quizzical, and the enjoyment comes in that quizzicality. That's a word, right? Quizzicality.
I completely respect that. And I love, Brad, I love that you love these movies. Let me make that clear, because first of all, somebody has to love these movies. But I also love that part of the reason you just embrace films like this is because of that. Like, I do admire that. And for me personally, what I need when it comes to a film like this is the schlockiness isn't enough for me, and the absurdity isn't enough. It almost has to be something like what's that movie called? Troll 2, where there's legit out loud, it's so bad, it's good type deal. So when I watch a movie like Halloween 3 and I'm just kind of like, well, nothing is quite, it almost gets there. There are a couple moments where it's like the moment where at the end, it turns out that what's her name? Ellie is a robot, which I don't think she was a robot. It's not entirely clear, but I don't think she was a robot the entire time.
No,
she wasn't. She was no. She that's so, the whole thing is like he sees her there. She is laying in the room. They're obviously laying the robot out there as, you know, bait for him to take her.
That's what I figured. But at the end when he chops off her head and that whole exchange is very, very ridiculous. But, you know, I need. If a bad movie makes me laugh out loud consistently, then I will forgive a lot. And unfortunately, Halloween 3 never, its bad moments don't excel beyond, like I said, the plot on paper sounds absurd. And in theory, I would be 100% head over heels, like, yes, this is ridiculous. If only it just felt more ridiculous. And you know what one of the things I realized was, Brad, when we were talking about Demon Knight, I think you mentioned to me, you said originally the demons were going to be businessmen. And I was thinking about that watching this, and I realized, I was like, oh my God, this is basically a really good example of what Demon Knight could have been in the wrong hands. But also, if they'd gone the route of using just these guys and, you know, as government agents or just that boring kind of bland thing, by insisting on having those really awesome demons in the film, that incredible makeup and those practical effects, it elevates the film and gives it a bit of an edge. And Halloween 3 doesn't quite have that edge. The guys turn out to be robots, but there's nothing
automatons
quite as they're whatever you want to call them. God, Brad, whatever you want to call them, there isn't enough of an edge to them to make them memorable. They're just bland robot people.
Let me jump in and say, I think this is almost like one of those things where it's an ink blot. Like, Sean, you and I definitely line up alike, but this is, I think it is such an interesting sort of thing, because you wind up walking this fine line, because we all love to watch a bad movie that can somehow entertain us, right? And we just have different lines in different spots. The reason I get so frustrated with this movie actually has nothing to do with it being part of the Halloween franchise. Like that's okay. They were trying for something. It didn't work, whatever. But the fact that I can sit there and I can watch a movie like this, and I see so many of these really neat concepts that are almost there, that with just a little bit more pre-production or one more pass at the script, the concepts, you could sit there and you could diagram it and you could say, okay, well, they're talking about the evils of consumerism, which of course is something that appeals to John Carpenter. You look at something like They Live, that's very much in the lexicon of a John Carpenter production, you know, to sort of warn you against the fact, you know, how does Silver Shamrock get there? By mass consumerism. And there's this undertone of the anti-hero and making you cheer for the bad guy in a sense. But then you look at his character and you say, man, if they had just put him in a different profession, like reporter, this whole plot works better rather than him being a doctor at the emergency room. It's like, what? You know, or have him be a bad cop. Have him be a jerk cop sort of thing, where it's like it's just in his nature to go seeking the truth about something like this, or, you know, or what have you. And so that's what gets me so frustrated with a movie like this. When I go in and I watch something like a Neil Breen movie, I know what I'm getting into from the start, right? There's no expectation there for anything. But I look at something like this and I say, you could have been successful and should have
been
successful.
There's talent involved. There's right. Legit talent involved.
And that's why I get mad. That's why I get mad at it.
But I also feel like, Brad, that's exactly like I'm sure you're listening to John right now and just thinking like, no, I don't want him to be a journalist, because how much more insane is it that he's a doctor?
Right. Yes. And I think it's mediocrity is what makes it interesting, right? Like it's easy to go like, oh, if you tweaked certain things, certain ways, the movie would be better. That, I mean, like you could say that about everything. Like 90% of art is crap. And if you're only looking for the Citizen Kanes of this world, you're just going to be mad over and over and over again. You got to look at the movie that you're presented with. And it's those weird choices of like, yeah, why isn't he a cop? Why is he a doctor? And why is this doctor going down this rabbit hole of investigation? And it's that slightly off nature to Halloween 3, which I find appealing. It's why I love Roger Corman movies, because there's leaps in logic and leaps in character that don't quite line up. But sets it apart from the obvious.
I want to present a theory here that I actually think is true. And I think, again, we kind of touched on it a little bit. And I think a lot of people have said, you know, if this wasn't a Halloween movie, I think it would have been more successful. I don't agree with that. I think its success, whatever success you can attach to it, is because it's in this franchise. The reason it's memorable and the reason it truly stands out is because of its place in this franchise and everything about it that's fascinating, everything about it that gives it the appeal it has is because of the fact that it doesn't belong here. And yet here it is, Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. It will forever be in every Blu-ray set that you buy for this movie franchise. People discovering the series for the first time will watch it, will feel that utter bafflement at what's happening and why, where is Michael? So I would argue that this has to be a Halloween movie. It has to be a part of this franchise in order to achieve the full effect, I think, that it has.
Well, it certainly adds a layer of mystique and puzzlement to it. And I think it probably extends its conversation in the mainstream horror world. I do think if it was completely separate from the Michael Myers franchise, it would still have fans. It would be a movie like The Entity, or I don't know, like Basket Case, or you know, whatever other horror films came out in the early 80s, because I think it is a very strange film. And when you watch this movie with a crowd that has put their money down to watch it, like when you go and watch it on a big screen, I've now seen it at the Alamo, I've seen it at the AFI Silver, and those crowds do eat it up. Because put yourself into the vibe of the movie. It's not a film that is going to win people over if you haven't kind of maybe given yourself over to its weirdness or mediocrity or absurdity or whatever.
But I'm saying, like, I'm totally willing to give over to its weirdness and its questionable choices until it tries to wrap itself up and it suddenly seems to hit this gas pedal for no reason to speed things up. And instead of having it's building slowly and kind of annoyingly, as it goes a little bit much to get there sort of thing. But once you hit the payoff, you're like, oh, okay, here's the turning point. And then it just bungles through that. And it's,
do you mean kind of just like the way it's like, how do we defeat these guys? Oh, just dump a bunch of shamrock pins on them.
That's part of it.
Great. I love that moment. You go, here's these guys. They've got that whole little computer set up and they just get rained upon by their own technology and get all zapped. Could that effect have been better? Sure. But I think it's a fun little moment. And then you have Dan O'Hurley doing that little slow golf clap. And, I love the dude in that moment.
But that's a part of my complaint. But that in and of itself in the grand scheme of the ending is actually a cute moment that I enjoy. Right. Especially the golf clap. I honestly think any of the weight to what's going on is Dan O'Hurley's work. Like, yes. He's great. Yes. I love watching him work. He's terrific. Yeah. There's a part of me, if he doesn't get zapped at the end of this, I'm thinking to myself, oh, well, I'm going to work this into RoboCop continuity. He went from here and he took over OCP, and it's just a few years later. Makes total sense. But like, what it is it just hits these moments to get them along to the end. It's almost like it knows how good the cliffhanger is going to be. And so it doesn't have the patience to reward you for getting to the big escape scene. It just wants to get there as quickly as possible. And as a result, there are these steps that are just skipped along the way. And so I almost wind up walking out with a feeling of this move, like they sort of in the editing booth realized, well, okay, we got to get a couple more showings in the opening week because people aren't going to be in love with this. And so they chop up a ton of stuff out of it. And so it feels staccato. It loses any of the rhythm that it has built up to that point.
And unlike other Halloween movies, there are a lot of director's cuts, and this movie does not have a director's cut, correct?
I don't think so.
It's got to have a TV cut. I don't think there's a director's cut, but it's got to have a TV cut because there's no way that when this showed on TV, I saw the resultant shot of the woman getting hit in the face with the beam.
Yeah.
Or the entire detail of a rattlesnake coming out of the kid's dissolved face to bite the, like, I remember seeing the dad get bitten, but they definitely cut that stuff up. And so as a result, like, they would always have TV versions specifically so that it could fit the 2-hour runtime while making the cuts necessary for, you know, young eyes that would happen across the thing. So there has to be a TV cut out there.
It is weird speaking to your point there, John, about the ending, because it feels like in a lot of ways, the climax is finally seeing that snake come out of that kid's mouth. And then the movie does sort of slow back down after they escape with the robot girl and all of that stuff. And then they have to ramp back up again to the climax. Mm-hmm. And so it does like hit the brakes, and that when it hits the brakes, that's maybe not the move you would want in that moment.
Right. And you could have had, you can second guess anything, but that's the thing, right? Is that cliffhanger ending, despite everything else, despite all of my complaints up to that point, to this day, I watch that cliffhanger ending and Tom Atkins plays it so perfectly that you want to forgive every mistake that came before. When he turns and slightly you know, is on the verge of breaking the fourth wall as he delivers that final stop it. It's such a great moment. And it's just one of those things where I just wish the movie deserved it as much as it should.
It's brilliantly played because I'm watching it knowing I think I'm almost positive I've seen the ending of this movie before, but I'd forgotten the way it played out with the kid having it on the channel. And then it's like, oh, it's okay. We turned it off. We canceled the broadcast. And the kid just goes, click, and it's back on. And I just thought the way it plays out, the pacing of it, and just the suspense of it was so clever and almost funny. Like, that was a moment that got a genuine laugh for me because it was so brilliant. Like, oh, we finally did it. Nope, easy. I'll change the channel. So I will agree. I think the ending of this film is really, really great and a great ending to a better movie. It's just almost like this weird, perfectly constructed moment that comes at the tail end of this experience where I was like, well, this movie could have been full of moments like this, and then it would have been so much better. But I do want to talk, because we're talking about things we liked, I do want to talk about some things I liked, because obviously we've been beating up on the movie. I want to throw Brad a bone. Some of the things I liked. First of all, the soundtrack is amazing. I wish it was available somewhere on vinyl, on streaming services. I loved the soundtrack so much, and I feel like I hear the influence of this film soundtrack in things like Stranger Things. It definitely feels like, even though the movie has this reputation of people not liking it, somehow that score is so good that it has kind of crept its way into the lexicon of this kind of cinema, the 80s horror cinema. So I love that. I genuinely loved the moment where he finds the old woman knitting and is like, hey, where's Ellie? And then the head falls off. That was a really genuinely creepy moment. I liked that a lot. And I loved to hate the jingle, the commercial jingle, which just drove me insane. But I did love the payoff, like I said, of the kid's face just getting ripped apart. And also the woman playing with the little medallion. And I don't know, I couldn't remember how she got it, but I thought it was so funny that her instinct was, what is this thing? Oh, there's a chip in it. I'm just going to keep poking it until something happens. And then it blasts her face off. And it's one of the few good gore moments in the movie. And I'm not a big gore fan, but especially for like a slasher movie or a film in the Halloween series, I expected there to be more creative kills. So that was one. And then the kid watching TV was one. I at least got those, but the rest of it, I was kind of like, oh, it would be nice if it wasn't just businessmen kind of just pulling people's heads off. But John, are there any moments for you that, like, besides the ending, that you really, really enjoy?
Well, first and foremost, I want to speak to the soundtrack. I think it is available on Spotify. I'm not entirely certain of that, but I think the soundtrack is great. And I think that something that gets overlooked sometimes, because everybody knows Carpenter composes music for his movies too, but I definitely think the period in time where Alan Howarth joins him, from like Halloween 2 forward, the music just goes off the charts better. Like, as much as I love the first Halloween most of all, the score for Halloween 2 is the better of the two, hands down. Without question. Howarth is a great collaborator with Carpenter. I do think that there are, I agree with the woman fiddling with the chip sort of thing. I do think that there are just legitimately interesting things. This is a movie that's full of such interesting concepts that, as much as I don't like reboots and remakes, I would love to see somebody come at this material and redo it now. I do find it interesting, because you talk about the gore factor, that we have that perfect setup of one of the robots, I'm sorry, automata, showing up to
thank you,
put the drill into the coroner's head or whatever, and like it, but it cuts away, and it's like that's an odd moment, because even Halloween 2 recognized the need to up the game in terms of the gore factor because the landscape had changed, and this one. I'm always so surprised that they don't have some sort of cheap shot of the drill going into the ear sort of thing. I thought that was a really interesting move. And I actually like the scene better because of it, because something like that, I don't want to see. And if you put it in my brain anyway, that, you know, that's a good way to handle it. And again, I think that just, you know, the even though it's a slow build, it is not so maddening slow that you're willing to walk away from it. It doesn't ask too much of you on the walk up. And I think that just as a final mention, I will always love the shot, the moment where the first robot sets itself on fire.
Because that's what I was
the glassy eyed expression, you know, that's a great, great moment. And, And I love I love the gas station attendant too. Yeah. I think he's just a fun character, and he's played really, really for some silly fun.
Brad, what about you?
Well, I love that moment when the android lights himself on fire in the car in front of Tom Atkins. The first time you watch that, I find that scene to be quite unsettling. And I like the idea of how that truly disturbs Kalis's character and sets him on this mystery, plus the daughter of the dead dude being so cute, he feels compelled to do it. And I like also how when he does go to this weird town, it is very Stepfordy, and you know they call it the company town, and the guy at the hotel clerk, it's all uneasy, and I like that unease. I wish they explored the town a little bit more, and we peeled back the veneer of that place a little bit more as well. But I like that as just a general setup. Again, Sean, you mentioned how it has like a little bit of an Invasion of the Body Snatchers feel to it, where everyone seems slightly off. I like all of that quite a bit. I mentioned before we started watching the movie the other night, is the cinematography by Dean Cundey, I also think is quite strong. And I love the night shots when Tom Atkins is crawling around the roof of the factory, and you've got this ridiculous silver shamrock emblem behind his shoulder on the wall, and they've like pumped, you know, smoke in front of the lens. I think the movie looks really, really nice.
I liked the trick or treat stuff too. I thought that was definitely some of the money shots, and obviously one of the posters for the film is the kids walking. I don't know if we ever get that extreme color. It would have been nice. I think because, again, I'm trying not to compare it so much to the other films that I've seen in this franchise, because I know it's not quite the same, but they do make a point of it's Halloween. This is happening on Halloween. But I loved the way John Carpenter captured the mood of the season and the leaves and everything like that. And just the fact that we're so in this kind of sterile world and the small town vibe, like you said, Brad, I think that's a great idea. I would have loved to see a little bit more of these people kind of brainwashed, and maybe even kind of a Wicker Man thing where at the end, it turns out the whole town was in on it. And now they're going to like sacrifice the doctor. He's going to be the one to be the ultimate sacrifice that will open the doors. Oh, a healer of life. You've saved so many lives. And by taking yours, it'll be the ultimate sacrifice. You know, there's just some fun angles to play there that I think they could have taken advantage of. And something else too, I thought the whole TV element, kind of like what John was saying, was going to play a bigger role. I thought they kind of hint at it in consumerism and how television is brainwashing kids, but they don't go full on into it. I almost wish they'd done that. Again, just a little bit of polish would have helped make that.
I also think like their budget's so low, right? Like they still have a slasher movie's budget. So it would be awesome to really explore the television side, to meet some, you know, characters within the studios or what have you, and explore the technology. But they really, all they can afford is IBM consultants on the loose.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, that, you know, to speak to the television thing again, gets the idea of how ripe this is for a more modern take, for somebody to take this and remake it, call it whatever you want to, you know, pay Carpenter a truckload of money or whatever. But it almost seems, and this is where I'll say something really nice about it. It seems that the biggest problem for it is it's so far ahead of its time, in a sense, accidentally, because you could see this movie being done where what the kids have to watch is like an app on their phone or something like that. And that makes it even more diabolical because there's no way to stop it. How are you going to stop it, sort of thing? And it changes the landscape and everything like that. But it's almost as if modern society is even more set up for the kind of commentary that maybe this movie was trying to make. It just was, almost like a prophet who can see 10 years down the line and you're only thinking 2 years down the line. And then when it comes to pass, you go, oh, wow, that guy knew what he was talking about. You know, that sort of thing.
At the end, when he's going to say, stop it, he's only saying stop it to three channels, right? Like, all they had to do was shut off three channels. Whereas, like, today, it would be like 900 channels, an infinite amount of channels.
And also because you're broadcasting from like a satellite or whatever, there's no end to, are people streaming it? Are people watching it via another means? But I wonder, it won't happen, but I'm just saying this because I wonder if this would be a fun topic of conversation. Do you think this is something that would ever be revisited in one of these Halloween requels? We're getting a couple of them. Do you think there's any aspect of Season of the Witch that maybe even as like an inside joke they might address in these sequels? Or do you think they just look at this as like, nope, that's the, we learned our lesson, never again?
No, they already had their in joke in the Halloween that came out in 2018, because there were kids on the street in the three silver shamrock masks that walked by camera.
That's great. Yeah. I wouldn't have known that, but all right. Well, I feel like I'm getting a lot off my chest. I feel like, John, I hope you feel somewhat validated. And Brad, mm-hmm. I hope we didn't break your heart too much, but it's there anything else? Is there anything else that you guys want to say about Halloween 3 that we haven't said already that you feel needs to be said? And Brad, we'll start with you.
Oh, I mean, I don't know. Like, to me, I always have a good time with this movie. It's such a strange film. That's where I end up falling on it. And I don't know. I think it's a good looking movie. I think Tom Atkins is incredibly watchable. I love the gore of this film. And I wish the franchise had been, it followed this concept rather than the Michael Myers concept. There, that's what I think.
John?
I too wish it had not followed the Michael Myers concept, because that clearly illustrated what we would call the law of diminishing returns, without doubt. I will say that as much as I might have been beating up on this movie, I can't escape it. And Sean, you were complaining about the commercial and the music for the commercial. Halloween's never going to be the same for you, buddy. Just welcome to the club. Every Halloween, as soon as somebody says, hey, Halloween's coming, in the back of your brain, you're going to go, dun, 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 dun. 8 more days till Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. You can't get it out of your brain. It's done.
Oh, no, you're right. I was even walking around thinking about it, and I was like, well, we're still a couple weeks away. I can't say 14 days till Halloween. Oh, no.
It works.
I
can't. Oh, yeah.
Damn it. I think, as I said, I think this movie needs to be part of this franchise. And in a way, that to me is the most endearing thing about it, because I do want to acknowledge that I'm glad I had the time to watch the documentary. It's a lot of people that like very clearly cared about what they were doing. And I feel bad for Tommy Lee Wallace and the fact that this movie got so much hate. It's not that much of a surprise that it did, but I'm glad that people are kind of finding it and latching onto it in a way they didn't when it was first released. But I think even without Michael Myers, it needs to be a part of this. And I agree, I kind of would have liked to see this series take on an anthology mode of thinking, like that kind of mode of filmmaking and storytelling. But what Season of the Witch is missing is its Michael Myers. There's nothing that's quite as iconic or as threatening or as frightening as Michael. And I think that's its biggest downfall. But overall, I'm not mad I watched it, at least. I'm glad. And I think I appreciate what everyone involved in the project was going for. But I guess our final ratings, we'll do is silver shamrock medallions, Brad, on a scale from 1 to 5, with 1 being the lowest and 5 being the highest. How many would you gift Halloween 3 Season of the Witch?
I was surprised that when I went on the Letterboxd last night after I watched it, that the last time I saw it, which was at the AFI, I gave it 4. And initially I was like, oh, I was going to give it 3.5, but I'll go with my gut feeling or I'll go with my original feeling of 4, which is it the most honest feeling? I don't know, but I'm sticking with 4.
All right. And what about you, John?
I don't want to be mean to the movie, and I want to recognize that it is still one of the great cliffhangers. So my logical Spock brain says 1.5, but my heart will give
this
it
ain't
2.
Attack of the Clones, just, man.
Okay, you don't want to start this conversation. I will give it 2 stars simply because of the commercial and the ending. So I'll bump it an extra 0.5 star because I'm feeling generous today.
I think after watching that documentary, I will give it 2 stars as well, especially, again, just the sheer sincerity with which it was made and the genuine love. I can't help but admire kind of the sheer gall of making it. But that's that. 2 out of 5, 2 silver shamrock medallions. So, gentlemen, I thank you for joining me. I feel like we were able to get a lot out on the table. We were able to vent. We were able to express emotions. We had some laughs. We cried a little. I cut all that out so the audience wouldn't have to experience the awkwardness of it. John, you, as a fellow Nerd Party member, you have at least one or two podcasts, don't you, that are going on? Why don't you tell the people at home about it?
Oh, sure. You can find me here on the network on a regularly occurring show called Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast, a Parsec award-winning show, actually. We have a lot of fun with that one. And you can find me on a couple of archived shows, but you can also find me most recently on House of Fincher, where we looked over all of the directorial efforts of David Fincher in the lead up for his Netflix movie starring Gary Oldman, Mank. And if you want to find me on social media, look for Kessel Junkie on Twitter and Letterboxd and blah, blah, everywhere else. And over on KesselJunkie.com, where I love to write.
And Brad, where can the people find you as well?
First off, I really had to go and crap on Attack of the Clones to the guy who has the Aggressive Negotiations podcast. For that, I'm apologizing.
Oh, it's all good.
But I am appearing on the Pod Wars podcast to discuss Anakin and Padme's relationship this weekend. So go check that podcast out. Ooh. We're going to be talking about that. You can find me everywhere else on Twitter, Instagram, @MouthDork. Listen to my wife and I talk about comic books on Comic Book Couples Counseling podcast. Of course, there's Rest in Pictures, where we celebrate the legends that have left us, me and my buddy Aaron Prescott. So I'm all over the place. I feel like, personally, I let down all the Halloween 3 fans out there who are like, man, I wish I had been on this podcast to properly defend this movie.
No. I think you did an admirable job.
You did the best job that any human being could possibly do defending this movie, Brad. Accept that for whatever you will.
And I'm @YeSeanDorman on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram @SeanDorman, and I'm on Letterboxd as well. Same thing, SeanDorman. I want to thank my guests again. Gentlemen, always a pleasure speaking with you. 14 days till Halloween, Halloween, Halloween.
14 days till Halloween, silver shamrock.
Only.